By contrast, radical feminism doesn't say that there are some issues on which men and women differ or should be approached differently. It says there is a fundamental class conflict based on gender. It says that men and women do not share the same basic human needs and interests politically, such as freedom of speech or the protection of private property. The two genders do not have the same political interests, and this is like saying that a doctor saying that the two sexes do not have the same basic biology. Thus, what many of us would consider to be a basic human right, such as freedom of speech, for example, becomes a tool by which men oppress women through pornography, through the very use of language, such as history rather than herstory. How did this come about? The idea of class conflict is widely associated with Karl Marx, who popularized it. He didn't originate it by any degree, but he popularized it. He said that people were either workers or capitalists. In short, he divided up humanity by looking at your relationship to the means of production. And he said that the two classes that came about were inevitably and irresolvably at war. He made a further claim. The political interests of every worker was the same, just as the political interests of every capitalist was the same. And this was true whether or not any particular or worker or capitalist knew it to be the case. I don't know how deeply you've read in the theory of a radical feminist theory. If you haven't read deeply at all, I understand it. It gets very dry and rather discouraging. But radical feminism in the late 1970s and early 1980s consciously adopted this theory. And if you read the most important theorist of this time, Catherine MacKinnon, Toward a Feminist Theory of the State, for example, she uses the word post-Marxist feminism, where she takes the whole Marxist paradigm and takes the idea of worker capitalist out of context and uses gender instead, male-female. And this becomes the sorting point at which humanity is divided, where you no longer have a shared common humanity, but you're sorted into antagonistic political interests, where the interests of every woman are the same, just like every woman, every worker is seen to be the same, just as the political interests of every man is the same, just as every capitalist would be the same. And this is true whether or not the individuals involved know it to be true or not. Thus, radical feminism can look at a man and can level at him the accusation of rapist, of abuser of woman, even if that man has never abused a woman, even if that man has defended women, because he as a male, as a member of that class, benefits from the rape culture and therefore shares all the political interests of men. If this class analysis makes absolutely no sense to you, welcome to my world. As far as I can see, both men and women are human beings. All of us benefit from the same political circumstances, like freedom of speech, freedom of consciousness and conscience, private property, the right of self-defense. Any particular man is no more my enemy or my friend than any particular woman. We are all individuals to be evaluated individually. Now, I hope you can see how this attitude, this difference in attitude toward men, which is embedded very deeply in theory, and it's not merely that you like men or you like particular men in your life, they treated you well or badly, it's embedded in the ideology. I hope you can see how this has widespread implications. And let me give you just one concrete example. Marriage. Both radical feminism and I feminism want to revolutionize marriage. Radical feminism wants to eliminate the traditional marriage, the traditional family, because it wants because it's seen as a breeding ground of patriarchy, a source of women's oppression. I feminism looks at marriage and wants to revolutionize it as well. Basically, what we see is just individuals making choices about who to love, who to live with, who to have children with. Choices that are valid, whether or not it's heterosexual, homosexual. Basically, what iFeminists want to revolutionize is to eliminate the state, is to get rid of the state in marriage and in every single personal choice that an individual makes about his or her own sexuality and his or her personal relationships. That's the revolution that iFeminism envisions. This leads into my last point of theory, which is, I promise, my last point of theory. Radical feminism and iFeminism operate differently in society. I use the concept of equality to show how ideas differ, how they're diametrically opposed. I used class to show how there's a difference of attitude, in this case toward men. I want to use the concept of justice to illustrate the difference in methodology. For radical feminism, justice is an end state. By which I mean, radical feminism has a specific picture of what constitutes a just society. A just society is one without patriarchy, white male culture, which oppresses women, and capitalism, which is one of the tools by which the oppression occurs. It is a society in which the socioeconomic and cultural equality of women is fully expressed, one in which employers aren't forced to pay men and women equally for the same work, pornography and prostitution do not exist, sexual comments in the workplace, poof, gone. By contrast, the iFeminist view of justice doesn't have an end state in mind. It doesn't have an end state in view, any more than it defines what is a marriage. That's defined by the people who are involved. What justice is in individualist feminism is a process, and it can be expressed as anything that is peaceful, anything that is voluntary. In other words, any situation or outcome to which the people involved have consented is by definition just. You may make a foolish choice, a bad choice, a mistake, may end up badly, but as long as you agreed to the process by which you arrived at every single stage of that process, then that end point is a just one. Now, again, aspects of society that result may or may not be moral. Just as I said that culture may or may not offend you, aspects of the society may or may not be moral. For example, society may have very great stains of racism. I'm anti-racist. I married into an Hispanic family. My married name is Rodriguez. And I feel very strongly about anti-racism, about people being cruel to my nieces and nephews, about refusing to hire family members. And if any of this were to happen, I would become very upset, and I would use every single peaceful means at my disposal to change their behavior, including shouting in their face. What I wouldn't do is use force, either directly or in the form of government, to make those people treat my family differently, to make them treat me differently because of my last name, were I to use it. Why? Because the freedom of association that those people are expressing by refusing to hire my family because they're Hispanic, or refusing to hire me because I'm a woman, the freedom of association that they are expressing is something that I claim for myself and that I claim for my family, which is a basic human right to say yes or no to who should enter your parlor, who you should deal with, who you should sell to, and who you should hire. So the main difference between how radical feminists and iFeminists approach society and social change is not that one of them cares and the other one doesn't. It's that one of them uses the state and the other one doesn't. One of them uses force to institutionalize social change, which I think is a disastrous course. I don't think it can ever work. You can never get goodwill at the point of a gun. And the other one uses educational, nonviolent means. And this difference in approach makes sense when you think about it, because after all, the radical feminist ideal of justice can be imposed by a gun. It can be established by force. Radical feminists want a particular arrangement of society, and it's possible to impose specific arrangements. For example, you can impose affirmative action policies and arrest or otherwise punish anyone who does not abide by them. That's an absolute possibility. It's not possible for individualist feminism to do anything like this. We don't have that option. You cannot use force to impose a voluntary society. You cannot put a gun to someone's head and say you are now free to choose. What choice is taking that gun away and say, now that there is no gun, what do you want to do? That's what choice is. And the final analysis, this is what iFeminism is talking about. It is talking about choice. Its view of equality is the equal protection of person and property for no other reason that everyone can use their own judgment in order to choose how to use their person and property. That's the bottom line. So, having sketched the difference between the ideas, attitudes, and approaches to society of the old feminism and individualist feminism, let me move on to what I believe is the greatest challenge to feminism in general at this moment in the 21st century as it dawns. And that is to make the law and the application of the law, for example, in courts, in the policies of the police departments, absolutely gender blind. And to me, this is not a revolutionary goal. This is a reformist goal, but it's a goal that has to be done before anything else can be accomplished. The law has to be gender blind. In some cases, this means removing what have been considered to be goals, the achievements of women, that women have basically embedded privileges into law. Those have to be rolled back. In other cases, it means getting rid of bias against women. Those things have to be rolled back equally. Let me deal first with the bias that unfairly favors women. And this leads me naturally into an examination of the men's movement. If those of you haven't, those of you may have in the audience may not have heard of the men's movement. The men's movement is a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that are dedicated to removing bias against men from the system. And it is a movement that is about to explode. It is the angriest, rawest, most energy behind it movement I've seen in a very long time. I think it reminds me of nothing so much as feminism when it first started out, when feminism basically was something that was being discussed in 1965, and all of a sudden it just was in your face and was something you were dealing with in issue after issue after issue in the early 70s, because it just exploded off the cultural scene. I think the men's movement is about ready to do that. Let me tell you a story that maybe illustrates why. In the early morning hours of January 7th, 43-year-old Derek Miller walked up to a security guard at the entrance to the San Diego courthouse, where a family court had recently ruled against him on an overdue child support. Clutching court papers in one hand, he drew out a gun and blew his skull off with the other. Before doing so, he said, "This is what you've done to me." Miller is not an isolated case. Consider Warren Gilbert, who died of carbon monoxide poisoning, clutching a letter from the Child Protection Service, or Martin Romachick, the New York City police officer who hanged himself after being denied access to his children due to charges brought by his ex-wife, which the court later found to be frivolous. I could go on and on with stories that are heartbreaking. If you deal with these people on an individual basis, which I do, it's heartbreaking. And one of the things that's the worst are the testimonials from children who basically say, now I'm without a father. Because he was assessed twice what his living salary, what his salary, take-home salary was in child support payments, I no longer have a father or child support. One thing is clear, there is an alarming rise in male suicides in most Western nations, and according to the 1999 Surgeon General's report, suicide is the 8th leading cause of death in America, with men being 4 times more likely to kill themselves than women. A round of studies conducted in North America, Europe, and Australia suggests that one reason for the increase may be the extraordinary discrimination fathers encounter in family courts, especially regarding the denial of access to their children. Now, feminism has to extend a hand of goodwill toward these men who are being destroyed by the system. Just as feminism tried to redeem women who were being raped and no one listened to them and were being destroyed by the system in the 60s, they have to basically do the same common decency toward men right now. And they have to do so whether or not the bias in the system supposedly benefits women. And by the way, I don't buy it for a minute. I don't buy it. I don't buy that having privileges under the law that discriminates against men in any way benefits me. Faith writes of the various ways that midwives are being currently eliminated, quote, the lobbyist for California consumers' attorneys privately told us they would permit midwives to remove the unworkable supervisory clause. And that's the legal restriction that says that physician supervision is necessary for home birth, with no corresponding requirement that doctors themselves have to provide home birth supervision. Getting back to the quote, they would permit midwives to remove the unworkable supervisory clause if we swapped it for a mandatory malpractice insurance clause. We, of course, would love to have equivalent to doctors' malpractice insurance, but our pool of midwives is so small that premiums for coverages would be twice our annual income. Every time a midwife transfers a laboring woman to the hospital and an on-call obstetrician gets notified to come in, he makes a complaint to the medical board that she is practicing without a physician's supervision. When the medical board prosecutes a midwife, the price tags to the practitioner for legal practice, for legal fees, is $50,000 to $100,000. The last straw is that there are no direct entry midwifery schools in California. So we are now capped at the max number of 130 midwives, as there is no way to get licensed with moving to Florida or Washington State and doing a 3-year out-of-state program. Bottom line for all of this is that we are moving toward a return to underground lay midwifery and a massive resurgence of unplanned, unattended, do-it-yourself births, which everyone knows are far less safe than anything that is above the board. I could just cry, and I'm with you, Faith, I could just cry too. End quote. Of course, midwives are not the only victims of this planned obsolescence. Some would say they're not even the primary victims. I'd say that. Women, every woman, is being victimized by this because she and her daughter are being told that they cannot control the circumstances of the birth of their own children. That's something that authorities, boards, government can put the laws down and regulate. Now, again, these are two issues that illustrate the greatest challenge that I think is facing feminism, getting gender bias out of the law. Just get it out of the law and the application. But to be more specific, and having given you a sense of the theory that underlies iFeminism and with some examples of how that theory has been applied, translates into real issues, let me give you that whirlwind tour that I promised of the issues. And I'll do so from quoting from Liberty from Women, because all these issues are covered within there and more. And having said that, let me remind you of one thing. I started by grounding individualist feminism in abolitionist women, the anti-slavery women from the 19th century, who argued that all human beings, white, black, male, female, are self-owners. If you put that sentiment into 20th century feminist terms, you get the principle. It is a woman's body, it is a woman's right. And remember that principle, because that really is, from the 19th century to the 20th century to the 21st century, what's being applied all the way through. Pornography and prostitution. As long as everyone is involved is a consenting adult, it's their business, and the law should not intrude. As Martha Nussbaum concludes in Liberty for Women, the true role of feminism is to expand the options that sex workers face and to increase protection for those who choose that path. Affirmative action and other regulation of employment. Every business owner has the right to use his or her own property as he or she sees fit, including the hiring or firing, refusal to hire anyone for any reason based on their own judgment. And since I've discussed that issue already, I'll move on. Sexual harassment. As long as there is no force or threat of force involved, as long as the harassment is verbal, it deserves the protection of free speech. Most employers today would probably enforce codes just because the society right now would not tolerate the kind of abusive, offensive language that was directed at women in the 50s and 60s. And that would be fine, because they can enforce anything they want on their own property, just as I can enforce codes in my parlor for dinner guests. But the law has no business regulating words and attitudes. As Kathy Young declared in Liberty for Women, quote, an individual's non-coercive sexual behavior is no one else's business, and a lawsuit based on sexual misconduct should involve actual damages to the plaintiff, end quote. The choice to be a housewife. It's just that, it's a choice. Every bit as self-respecting as the choice and to become, own your own business, to climb the corporate ladder and be a CEO. I think Mimi Gladstein's article in the anthology is probably the first feminist defense I have ever read, contemporary, of housewives and houseworks. And housework, basically as valid in itself, but also as a perfect springboard. She basically describes how, if it were not for her experience as being a mother and it's not tongue-in-cheek, it's very serious, for being a mother and a housewife, she could not possibly have become the dean of literature at the U of T in Austin. Violence against women. Now here the force of law is appropriate. What isn't appropriate, however, is to deny women the ability to defend themselves. The right of gun ownership should be respected. Richard Stevens has a terrific piece that not only debunks gun control myths, but argues for gun rights along specifically feminist lines, quote, victim disarmament laws that discourage women from developing the skills and using defensive firearms actually heighten the bias, that heighten the risks of criminal violence that women face. Such laws place women at disadvantage against violent men and run against the feminist goal of equal treatment of the sexes under the law, end quote. Abortion. This is an interesting case because my personal belief it is a woman's body, it's a woman's choice. But one thing that iFeminism says, and one thing that we are unique about, is many of our members are pro-life. As long as you don't use government and you don't enforce your choices on other people, it's really up to you. If you can persuade someone not to have an abortion, I have extreme moral qualms about abortion. I have no legal qualms. It is legally a woman's body, woman's right, however I morally feel about it. If you can use persuasion and choice and all the nonviolent techniques, it's an active debate. I think our site and our tradition of feminism is the only form of feminism where this is an active debate between goodwill, people with goodwill. So, from this short list of issues, I think you can see where individualist feminism would fall on most other issues. So I won't go on with the laundry list. I'll end instead with a quick point and invite Q&A. And my quick point is this. Feminism desperately needs individualist feminism. It needs the infusion of this theory because it is dying. The mainstream of feminism has become utterly irrelevant to the lives of most people. You go to college campuses, you go into business. Most people either do not wish to define themselves as feminists. They find it somehow distasteful. They find it irrelevant. They say it may have spoken to my mother or my grandmother or my great-grandmother. What does it offer me? The housewife, the homeschooler, the women who love and value the men in their lives and are tired of male bashing, women who rise through merit and not privilege, women who disagree and are outspoken, like me, are not anti-feminists. They're the hardcore. They're the main body of feminism. They're the main body of women. They're the women who think and make choices for themselves. The mainstream of feminism has become so dogmatic that it views women who question, like me, as the enemy. Yet women who question is almost a definition of feminism itself. Alex Coburn, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, summed up the impact that iFeminism will have upon mainstream feminism when he said, "Liberty for women. It will jolt a near corpse back into life." By the corpse, he meant feminism. But after it is jolted, it will become alive and become the healthy, robust being it once was when women embraced men as partners and we all celebrated one thing, personal choice. Thank you.